You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And amazing stuff in the news. Rick Santorum wants to take us back to the 17th century. I got to tell you all about that. All of the intelligence agencies in the United States say Iran is not really working on a bomb. Why is it that that's all Fox News wants to talk about, the opposite of what our intelligence agencies are saying? And corporate spying? Mike Bonanno is with us. He's with the Yes Men. The YesMen.org is the website. Calling in from London. Mike, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Am I mispronouncing your last name, sir?
No, you're not.
Okay.
You got it right.
Great. So tell us, this apparently came out of this most recent WikiLeaks dump. What's the story?
WikiLeaks has revealed a trove of 5 million emails and other documents that were somehow gotten from Stratfor, a company that claims to be in the business of global intelligence. Actually, they claim now that they are a kind of a news distribution agency, which is a bit of a misnomer because they're spies, they're corporate spies. And it's very well.
But they're trying to claim First Amendment protection for their activities, huh?
Yeah, they want people to think of them in a positive light. But when you read some of the disturbing emails in there, it's anything but.
Well, what did those of those disturbing emails? What were the ones that talked about the Yes Men, and what did they say?
Well, the ones that caught our eye, of course. the reason that WikiLeaks got in touch with us is because they noticed that we were in there. Something like 500 or 600 times. And it turned out that Dow Chemical had hired them to monitor us because of our activities helping support the victims of the Bhopal catastrophe. And, of course, Dow would like people to forget about that. And so they're monitoring those Bhopal activists. They take note of all kinds of details in our lives. And when I say details, I mean of our digital life. So they follow what emails we send out to people. They see if we're listed somewhere and we're speaking at a college or university. And they just forward all of that information on to Dow. For the activists in Bhopal, it's quite interesting. They subscribe to any list that they have. They try to kind of infiltrate in ways that are sort of like quite soft, like legal.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to be their, their M.O., at least in
this is
in
like,
our case.
Like J. Edgar Hoover all over again, only this is a for-profit corporation doing this on behalf of another for-profit corporation.
The disturbing thing about Stratfor, especially as it emerges here, is that they're using a tremendous amount of tax money to do this kind of spying. They have many clients,
really?
Including many that are the U.S. government. But it's not like a closed system like, many of the government agencies are or used to be, because on the one hand, they have clients, private clients, who are paying for information. Sometimes it's information that they may also be paid for, from the government. And so it's a very kind of creepy and insidious way that our information is being privatized, and the security industry is very frightening that way right now.
Remarkable. What's the big picture here, simply put?
Well, the big picture is that corporations are colluding with other corporations to use techniques previously reserved for, government espionage to spy on both, activists and, in some cases, governments. And they're doing a lot of meddling, and they're doing it for profit. It's not in the matter of national interest anymore. It's all about their bottom line, and that becomes frightening.
And what was the role of Julian Assange and WikiLeaks in all this?
Well, WikiLeaks is releasing the documents. WikiLeaks is an organization that is involved in releasing information, getting information to people. And so although this information was available, apparently from an anonymous hack, parsing through it is something that has to be done quite carefully. And so they're basically providing the muscle to do that through their network of news agencies that are partners on the project.
Do you know the latest on the trials and tribulations of Julian Assange and WikiLeaks?
Well, you know, he's still under house arrest in the UK, fighting an extradition to Sweden. And, you know, interestingly enough, some of the information that came out in the Stratford case is about how companies like that, there's emails from the president of the company urging their people to try to take psychological control of informants using any means necessary, including things like sex scandals. So there's this, I'm not saying that these two things are related, it's just that the culture of that industry seems to stop at nothing. And so it comes as no surprise that Assange is having those problems.
That's remarkable. Well, you keep in mind, there were, I don't think that this has ever been actually nailed down. Maybe it has, and you can correct me, but many of the worst abuses at Abu Ghraib, for example, and other similar ones were apparently done by private contractors. And,
yeah,
you know, it's
I think that that's one of the problems here is that there's a lack of accountability, and there really is a lack of sort of professional training, too. The way that Stratford analysts often work their way up the chain was being hired as interns and asked to do things like read email, or not read email, but read communications or call information about groups like DAO activists. Eventually, they work their way up the food chain, and simply by learning on the job without any sort of moral or ethical training, they end up in positions of real power. And that becomes frightening.
And because they're not a government agency, they're not accountable to we the people. There's no oversight agency. There's no Congress that can cut off their funding or hold public hearings. There's nothing. It's a private corporation. They're answerable to their board of directors, which may be a very small group of people. I mean,
I mean, even more scary in a way than imagining them as a very competent organization that's acting out, you know, these different directives. It's really a case of information becoming very poor quality. You know, what they're doing, because they're trying to make a buck, you know, they have this bottom line. And so they will try to gussy up anything, any little bit of information that they've got to make it look really important. And there's an amazing glossary of basically spy terms, spy language that came out as a result of this leak. And it describes these different policies that they have to try to trump up information and make it seem more important so that it sells for a higher price.
Right.
Actually, so that the clients stay happy. That's the idea.
So it might not even be true. It's just what the clients want to hear. Hello? Oh, I think we've lost the Skype connection. Anyhow, that was Mike Bonanno. He's with the Yes Men. Yes Men, one of the really great groups, the YesMen.org, is their website. And they have been doing this, you know, they do a lot of I guess you could call it theater, you know, things that, and just some remarkable work. So anyhow, WikiLeaks is showing that they have been spied on. And in the midst of this, we have now a report coming out that a hotel workers union in New York just cut a really good contract with the Hotel Owners Association. And at the same time, corporate profits are higher than they've been in 60 years. But workers' wages, when adjusted for inflation, actually have dropped during this period of time. So what does Fox News choose to talk about? What do they call horrible? Or words to that effect? Is it that the corporate profits are up and workers' wages are down? No, it's that this one particular union in New York negotiated a really good contract on behalf of their workers. How dare they? I'll share a clip from that with you and some of the Fox News response to it after this. And I want to get to Colonial Williamsburg and Rick Santorum.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And how many U.S. government agencies say Iran is going to build a bomb? If you watch the news, you'd think all of them. You'd be wrong.
Roll down the windows with the radio loud. Come on, turn it up. Yeah, start living your life on the double. Leave your troubles behind. You and me, we're gonna be all right. You could be a black.
Welcome back, Tom. Tom Hartman here with you on the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program. And just a quick heads up, starting March 12th, instead of our program being live noon to 3, our program will be live 3. 3 to 6 p.m. Eastern time, just for your local time. And just some of the things that are coming in the news. Here's clip number one, Ricky Santorum. This is mind-boggling. Listen to this.
And early in the campaign, you talked about John F. Kennedy's famous speech to the Baptist ministers in Houston back in 1960. Here's what you had to say.
Very late in my political career, I had the opportunity to read the speech, and I almost threw up. You should read the speech.
That speech has been read, as you know, by millions of Americans. Why did it make you throw up?
Because the first substantive line in the speech says, I believe in America where the separation of church and state is absolute. I don't believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute. Absolutely, to say that people of faith have no role in the public square, you bet that makes you throw up.
So that's Rick Santorum. He wants to bring back the church writing the laws in the United States. So let's look at what we were like when the church wrote our laws. Before the Constitution was put into place, before the Revolutionary War, the Pilgrims came over here. Keep in mind, they first screwed up England, right? They put into place, I believe it was Oliver Cromwell. I'm sure Sue, who knows this stuff really well and lives in the UK, will correct me if I'm wrong here over in our chat room. But my recollection is that it was Cromwell and the Lord Protector, and the Puritans said to the British people, you know, okay, we've overthrown the king. You know, isn't it a wonderful thing? Aren't you happy? By the way, you can't dance and sing anymore, and if you're caught kissing in public, we're going to whip you. And so the British, after a few years, said, enough of this already. Oh, and you're not supposed to drink. Enough of this already. Oh, and no more dancing. Enough of this already. And they threw the bums out, and they brought the kings back. And so the Pilgrims and the Puritans were like, holy cow, we're being persecuted here in England. This is the story we learned in elementary school. You know, they came to America looking for religious freedom. Well, no, it was more like they were kicked out. And because they tried to take over the government. And they came here and they did. I'm here. Look at the website for Colonial Williamsburg. That the future may learn from the past is the slogan underneath it. This is from history.org/foundation/journal/spring03/branis.cmf. B-R-A-N-K. In any case, Sue can track it down. These are the statutes, the laws in Jamestown. This was put into place by the Virginia Company in London of 1611. This is the very early settlers. And the law said that the cause of the unjust and undeserved, the unjust, people who would engage in behavior that's unjust or undeserved, would be punished by starvage, hangage, burningage, breakage upon the wheel, and shooting to death. Some of the things that would cause this, running to the Indians to get relief and being returned again will be burned to death. Stealing to satisfy your hunger, you will be hanged. One person was chained to a tree till he starved to a death. Others attempting to run away in a barge and therein to adventure to their lives to their native country, being discovered and prevented, were shot to death, hanged, and broken upon the wheel, besides continual whippings, extraordinary punishments, working as slaves in irons for years. And that for petty offenses were dearly executed. Each Virginia minister was required to read the articles and laws and orders to his congregation every Sunday. Failure to attend church twice a day was punishable. First instance, loss of a day's food. Second offense by public whipping. And third offense, 6 months of hard labor rowing in the colony's galleys. Every minister was entitled to appoint four men in his fort or settlement to inform on religious scofflaws. This is like the morality police in Saudi Arabia. Every minister had four guys who were his morality police, and they would run around and catch people doing things. Boston's Roger Scott, for example, was picked up for repeatedly sleeping on the Lord's Day. He slept in instead of going to church. He was sentenced to be severely whipped for striking the person who waked him from his godless slumber. 1688 in Salem, Massachusetts, John Smith and his wife Kitchen were fined for frequently absenting themselves from church. In 1682 in Maine, Andrew Searle paid 5 shillings merely for wandering from place to place instead of frequenting the public worship of God. Captain Kimball, a seafaring man, came home from 3 years at sea, and as he walked off the ship, he kissed his wife in public. He spent several hours in public humiliation in the stocks. They had laws against masturbation, fornication, adultery, sodomy, and buggery. Thomas Granger of Plymouth, a boy of 17, was convicted in 1642 for buggery. He was hanged. The animal that he was buggering was also hanged. It was actually cast into a large pit. In 1642, Edward Preston was sentenced to be publicly whipped for his lewd practices tending towards sodomy with Edward Mitchell. In other words, he was flirting with another man. He actually didn't engage in it. No death penalty here since the actions only tended towards sodomy, but he was publicly whipped, and the man he was flirting with had to watch. The records tell of hundreds of colonial sinners forced to sit in the stocks in public view, scorn of bystanders, garbage and worse hurled at them. There was a ducking school for scolds, usually women. They would dump them. Most village squares boasted, along with a church, a whipping post, as well as stocks and other engines of corrections. Whipping posts at convenient spots throughout the city. And when you were put through the stocks, they nailed your ears to the wood.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
This is Rick Santorum's Vision of America. 3 nails in each ear. Yes.
That's me in the corner. That's me in the spot. Like losing my religion. Trying to keep up you. And I don't know
why. There's other just amazing news. Sunshine Oil Sands. You ever heard of this company? Sunshine Oil Sands? They own 464,997 hectares of oil sands in Alberta, Canada. Okay, so one of the big, you know, one of the big chunks of oil sands in Alberta, Canada is owned by this company called Sunshine Oil Sands. Now, who owns Sunshine Oil Sands? They did an IPO last week. I was sitting on the plane this week. I went to Columbus, Ohio to me and Ed Schultz and Jeff Santos did this hoop-de-doop for our new affiliate there in Columbus. And it was, and so I'm sitting on the plane reading the Financial Times, and I read this. Sunshine Oil Sands, this is the first sentence. Sunshine Oil Sands, a Canadian tar sands company, has raised $575 million in a Hong Kong initial public offering. I'm like, wait a minute, they did an IPO in Hong Kong? The IPO is the biggest in the world so far this year. And so then I was like, okay, well, who now, you know, in an initial public offering, you sell your stock, and whoever buys your stock, if they buy a lot of it, they end up owning your company. The Sunshine, which is backed by Chinese state-owned investors, raised $350 million, or 60% of the total amount, from cornerstone investors, including China Investment Corp, China's Sovereign Wealth Fund, and Sinopec Group, China's biggest oil refiner. And I'm looking at this going, oh. Now it's starting to make sense. Okay, we get the oil, you know, the Chinese are buying the tar sands oil. Then we ship it across the United States, refine it down in Texas, let all the cancers from the refining go into Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, you know, across the southern Gulf Coast. And because, you know, we don't have any healthcare plan here, we don't have, you know, I guess, you know, people on a lot of these, most of these communities are poor and communities of color. So there's a lot, you know, basically you and I are paying for the healthcare expenses. The oil companies certainly aren't. And then they refine it into gasoline. And as I've said before many times, and USA Today pointed this out December 31st, 2011, in an article in USA Today, the last day of last year, that the number one export in the United States is gasoline. And it's about to go on steroids. It's about to get huger. Based in Calgary, Alberta, I'm reading from the Financial Times here. Based in Calgary, Alberta, Sunshine holds leases on 464,997 hectares of oil sands and plans to use the proceeds of the share sale to fund their development. You get this? Oh, back to Ricky Santorum. There was the pillory. In 1648, in Maryland, John Gonyer was convicted of perjury. He was nailed by both ears to the pillory, three nails in each ear, and the nails to be slit out and whipped 20 good lashes. That's what happens if you speak up to the church. The pillory is employed for witchcraft, fortune-telling, drunkenness, conjuring. On several occasions, onlookers, the pillory is about 15 feet above the ground. They put your head through a stock and your hands beside it. It's sort of like and then you just stand there. And on several occasions, onlookers pelted the pilloried prisoner so enthusiastically with heavy missiles that death resulted. People would throw stones at you and things. On April 23rd, 1771, the Essex Gazette of Newport, Rhode Island, reported that, quote, William Carlyle was sentenced to stand 1 hour in the pillory on Little Rest Hill, to have both ears cropped, to be branded on both cheeks with the letter R for rogue, and to be a fine of $100. And if he didn't pay the fine, he would have been put to death. Friedman, this historian of this era, says, for a colonial analyst, the sight of a man lopped of his ears or slit of his nostrils or with a seared brand or great gash in his forehead or cheek could not affect the stout stomachs that cheerfully and eagerly gathered around the bloody whipping post in the gallows. People with, quote, devilish opinions were banished. And if they returned, the penalty for returning was to have your ears cut off, your tongue bored through with a hot iron, and being whipped until the blood ran. If you had a devilish opinion, if you didn't like the church. And Rick Santorum wants to bring back the church. Not only that, Rick Santorum thinks you shouldn't go to college. Here's what Rick Santorum, here's little Ricky talking about, you know, the big problem of Obama wanting people to go to college. Play this.
President Obama once said he wants everybody in America to go to college. What a snob. Well, I understand why he wants you to go to college. He wants to remake you in his image.
Santorum actually declared in another clip, I don't think we have this clip, over the weekend, he said 62% of kids who enter college with some sort of faith commitment leave without it. Okay. And therefore, we shouldn't send kids to college. But the study that he was quoting was a study from the journal Social Forces, according to Public Broadcasting Service. And this is the claim on which Santorum's claim is based. And what they found is that while 64%, it wasn't 62, the number that Santorum quoted, it was actually 64% of those currently enrolled in a traditional four-year institution have curbed their church attendance habits, yet 76% of those who never enrolled in college but who are the same age report a decline in religious service attendance. So you're more likely not to go to church if you don't go to college than if you do. That sentence was full of double negatives. Here's the bottom line. Somebody needs to call Santorum and tell him. If you go to college, you're less likely to go to church. I think this is just like what happens when people grow up. And, they used to go to church with their families as kids because their families thought, hey, this is something I need to do for my kids. That's what my parents did. They took me to church. When I moved out of my parents' house, I stopped going to church pretty much. And I went back for a while. But it is a whole long story. But in any case, what they found is that while 64% of people who go to college stop going to church, 76% of people of the same age who don't go to college, who just get a job or go to trade school or whatever, they don't go to church. Isn't that weird? In fact, a quarter of the students, 25%, say they have become more spiritual since entering college, as opposed to only 7% who say they've become less spiritual. So Ricky Santorum has the numbers absolutely upside down. But still, he's calling President Obama a snob for wanting you or your kids to go to college. Totally weird. And he thinks we should be living in a theocracy. Now, on top of that, this housekeeper story. This is incredible. American corporate profits are going up like never before. Okay, corporate profits have made it back to their pre-recession heights. This Pat Garofalo reporting over Think Progress and rewritten, the one I'm reading from is from truthout.org. Corporate margins and profits are increasing, but workers' wages aren't. Okay, corporate profits last year, 2011, were the highest they've been in 60 years. Now, 60 years ago, workers' wages were going up substantially every single year. It built the great American middle class that lasted until Reagan came to office. Between 2009 and 2011, 88% of national income growth went to corporate profits, while just 1% went to wages, a statistic that is historically unprecedented. But there are a few people who are getting better wages, and they're the ones who've got good, strong unions fighting for them in big cities where they, and, you know, and in industries where there's a fair amount of money floating around. For example, the hotel industry in Manhattan. Hotel rooms in Manhattan are very expensive. There's a lot of money. People, you know, Trump owns one, you know, there's all these fancy hotels. So the housekeepers have negotiated a 7-year contract, Unite Here Local 6, the New York Hotel Trades Council, a 7-year contract, and over a 7-year period, the wage of the housekeeper, now this is not easy work, being a housekeeper in a hotel. This can be very difficult work. You got to deal with a lot of strange people. Physically it's hard. You're dealing with a lot of chemicals. You're moving things around. It can be backbreaking work. They have negotiated a pay raise from $46,000 a year to 7 years from now, $60,000 a year. What does Fox News have to say about that? Fox News has a very specific opinion about that. Jacob, you want to play that clip?
There's a new union proposal that would give housekeepers a raise to nearly $60,000 a year, plus medical coverage with no out-of-pocket expense to them and no doctor copay. That is the union demand. Any comments, Sandra?
Interesting how all of this sort of follows the whole DSK nightmare, but we're talking about 30,000 hotel maids across New York City, a 29% increase. This is a long-term contract,
yes,
a seven-year contract, not just medical, dental, optical, no out-of-pocket expenses. This is a nightmare.
This is a nightmare. The millionaire commentators on Fox News sitting talking to each other saying, holy cow, the maids are going to fall into the middle class. Are you kidding? 60,000, this is incredible. The fact of the matter is $60,000 a year in America these days is a lot of money when the median income in this country is $25,000 a year. Consider that, $25,000 to $26,000. The average household income in the United States is around $44,000, which means that most households have a little less than two people working. And that's what it takes in America these days. So the hotel maid's got a good deal. Why are the people at Fox saying this is a nightmare? Why aren't they saying, geez, let's get everybody up to this level? You know, the cameramen, they should be making that. And the taxi drivers should be making that. And everybody should be making that. I find it just incredible. This corporate profits are at a 60-year high. The best year corporations have had in 60 years was last year. And the maids get a 29% increase over a 7-year period, and Fox calls it a nightmare?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So these are some of my major thoughts for the day. In the next hour, I want to get into Iran also, what's going on with that. We'll pick up your calls right after this break, 45 minutes.
I get knocked out.
Welcome back. Last week we talked about the one of the offshoots of the Occupy Wall Street movement, which is the 99% movement that is starting to get organized and starting to lobby and things. Now there is an occupation party that has split off. The co-chair and spokesperson for the Occupation Party, theoccupationparty.com, the website. Tyrone Givens is on the line with us. Hey, Tyrone, what's up?
Good to be here, Tom. Thanks for the invite.
Tell us about the Occupation Party.
Well, to start, our website's theoccupationparty.org.
.org. I'm sorry. It says .com on my call screener, but on my paper here, it's .org. You're absolutely right. So .org it is.
Thank you. We got our act together and got started back in October, and we started as a local Occupy down in Cincinnati called Occupy Clifton,
mm-hmm.
and we decided that our efforts at direct action could only achieve so much, and that the next logical step would have to be to infiltrate politics and occupy Congress,
right,
carry our message into the government, and help transition the current system into what we all need.
Right. Do to the Democratic Party what the Tea Party did to the Republican Party. Take it over.
Exactly.
Take it over. Okay, so what are you doing to that effect?
Well, we are established as a 527. Mm-hmm. We're based in Ohio. We are a real political party, not just in Maine, we're finding and vetting candidates to run on the 2012 ticket. We will not support or endorse any presidential candidate whatsoever.
So you're not going to get in the way of that whole thing. This is a state-based thing. But you've got the Green Party there in Ohio. You've got the Democratic Party in Ohio. Ohio doesn't, like New York State does, it doesn't have fusion voting, does it? People can't appear on multiple party tickets.
Not yet.
Okay. So how's it going? Are you getting people showing up? Are you getting people who and are you able to get on the ballot? How long is it going to take, and what's involved?
Well, we're doing pretty good. As you know, in Ohio, it's already too late. The only thing we can do in Ohio is list candidates as write-in candidates.
I see.
We're still working in Michigan. We're gaining steam. We're gaining a lot of potential candidates. We've already endorsed Lance Enduro in Michigan, running as a Democrat.
Yep.
He's heavily involved in Occupy up there in Lansing.
Yep.
We're also promoting our own candidates who have no political background.
Uh-huh.
And one of our first ones was Corey Ray back in November. He's our first announced candidate. He's up in New York running for state assemblyman.
That's great. And he can appear on multiple ballots if it's possible. So, Tyrone Givens, the co-chair and spokesperson for the Occupation Party, the website theoccupationparty.org. And check it out. And I'm guessing that this model is probably going to go viral. Tyrone, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Good talking with you. I do truly appreciate it. Let's see here. Joe in Seattle, listening on Talk 1090, KTPK. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I got to tell you, I'm 60. I've been disabled half my life, and Social Security, Medicare, this is all important to me. And I'm also an atheist, and I guess I'm going to get a whipping here. That's all I can figure out.
Rick Santorum is president. But here's the problem. You know, there's a lot of Democrats in Michigan who are, and we're on a whole bunch of radio stations in Michigan. There's a whole bunch of Democrats in Michigan who are thinking that they're going to be too cute by half and vote in the Republican primary for Rick Santorum in order to deny Mitt Romney the nomination. If they do that and you get a brokered convention, there's a very good chance that the candidate, the nominee, is going to be somebody like Jeb Bush or Marco Rubio or Chris Christie, any of whom will give President Obama much more of a run for his money than Mitt Romney can do. So I would stay away from this thing. Let Mitt Romney become the nominee and let him try to run on a platform of being a multimillionaire and his wife having two Cadillacs.
Oh, my. And the thing that concerns me is that, do you actually think the Republicans are choosing either a Santorum or a Romney because they agree with them? Or do you think they just don't have anybody better to pick from and obviously won't go Democratic? The field is so poor.
I think the stronger candidates, and I think that would be the people that I just named, Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, Chris Christie, maybe the governor, you know, Mitch Daniels from Indiana, but probably not. But anyhow, I think that all of those people are waiting for another 4 years because they just don't. I think that they think, A, the economy is probably going to crash again in the next year or two because the fundamentals have not been changed. The Republicans have been very successful in the United States Senate from blocking any fundamental change. Glass-Steagall still hasn't been reinstated. The banks, you've got six banks now that control 65%, an amount of money equal to 65% of the GDP of the entire country. This is a disaster waiting to happen. We've got, you know, the stock market. You've got some incredible percentage, 70-some-odd percent of all the trades in the stock market are happening in less than a second back and forth. I mean, there's this, you know, high-frequency trading. There's all these structural things that have not been – we have no trade policy in the United States. We have no manufacturing policy in the United States. We have a tax policy that actually, if you make things overseas and you ship them back here, you can deduct the cost of shipping from your taxes. So you and I are paying for Apple to ship their goods from China here to the United States, and paying for the iron ore that's mined up in around Lake Superior to be shipped to China to be made into the raw materials for those Apple computers. I mean, it's just incredible. None of those fundamentals have changed. And I think that the Republicans are looking at this thinking, if we can just crash the economy hard enough, and I think that they're going to do it in the next two or three years, and maybe even before the election, but probably over the next two or three years, if we can crash the economy hard enough when there's a Democrat in the White House, then it'll be like what happened to Herbert Hoover, who, you know, the economy crashed when a Republican was in the White House. And for two generations, nobody wanted to go near being a Republican. And when they finally did in 1952, Dwight Eisenhower, the first Republican elected since 1932, it was 20 years later, you know, a whole generation later, literally. He ran on a platform of vote for peace, vote for Eisenhower. He was the peace candidate, and his whole thing was that he was going to end the Korean War. And he was, you know, today by today's standards, he would be a liberal Democrat. So, Joe, I think that that's what's going on. Thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening there in Seattle. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
You know, I've told the story a number of times on the air over the years and written about it. Back in 2001, I was down in Argentina, and it was right after the country had crashed as a result of IMF-imposed austerity like they're trying to do to, for example, Greece right now. And finally, they just said, you know, forget it to the IMF and pulled out, and the currency collapsed and everything, and all these factories closed. And the workers just said, you know, the factory's closed. We're still going to show up for work. And if the owners are going to, you know, take the money and run and leave the country, in many cases they did, we're going to take over the factories. And now there is a thriving sector in Argentina of factories that are actually owned by their employees. Now, I haven't seen anything move that far in the United States. There's a lot of them that have started that way, you know, employee-owned businesses. Peninsula, I think it is, manufacturing in Madison, Wisconsin is the most well-known. But occupying the factory. Well, we saw this done in Chicago a while back, and it's being done again right now. Armando Robles is with us. He is the president of the United Electrical Workers Union, UE1110, and ueunion.org. Mr. Robles, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for inviting me to your show.
Thanks for being with us. Tell us what's going on in Chicago.
Well, in 2008, the company, Republic Windows and Doors, decided to close the operations with not too much notice. It exists in the United States, a Warren Act, the one said the company has the obligation to let them know 60 days in advance to the workers and or pay the 60 days.
Right.
But in 2008, we have a successful sit-in. We stay for 6 days demanding to our benefits being paid, benefits that in that moment we own in that date, and they decide to don't give us anything. We sit in for 6 days. After 6 days in 2008, we come out from that sitting with 1.75 million to cover all our benefits. We did this against the Bank of America and Republic Windows and Doors owner.
Mm-hmm. So you were successful in 2008. Now they're trying to pull the same trick again?
And then 20 days after the December, after we get our money, which was December 19, 2008, a couple of days, one person see in the media our struggle, and they decide to buy the company, and they come with a lot of promise to us. Mm-hmm. They say they want to buy the company and rehire the whole workers. We have a contract, four years contract. This one was our third year contract starting in February 27, start our fourth year. But 2 days before the last Friday, on Wednesday, we received a call from the owner, Kevin Serres, from Sirius Energy. Previous name, it was Sirius Materials, who's purchasing all the equipment from Republic Windows and Doors. And he said he wants to talk to us. He was really, really mysterious. He don't say anything about it. He just give us, like, orders, be in this place. You're going to meet with my lawyers. But this person and this person is going to be there. And whoever you want to bring from the local 1110, it's your decision. Of right. course, it's a decision because we are a local union shop, and we know our union works inform of workers about any struggle, any situation. So we appear in the lawyer's office, and they announced that they're going to close operations in Chicago. They got three more factories in the United States, and they decide to close operations on Chicago, Illinois. And we ask when they plan to do that. They say immediately.
Hmm.
And they was planning give us under the 1 hour, paying us the money, but they say they're going to pay us every other week. Like, we're receiving our salary, which to us, that sounds really creepy and really, like, unacceptable. Because who's going to guarantee to us that they're going to do that?
Right. So are you guys occupying the factory again?
At the end, we go to the meeting on the lawyers, we try to have a settlement. We ask him for 90 days period to find another buyer, potential buyer, or probably the workers run the factory without bosses.
Uh-huh.
They start laughing about it. They refuse to. We insist a couple times. At the end, when we see the position of the company was not the best intentions to keep working operations. We left the lawyer's office, and we left just three people there negotiating, and two people coming through the factory informed our co-workers that the situation. We let know our workers that we don't have to leave the company until we have a resolution from the lawyer's office.
Right.
And at the end, around 5 o'clock. The people from the lawyer's office, our leadership, the people the union live in the lawyer's office negotiating, they call us and say, you know what, these people don't want to change their mind. They're going to close at the end. So we run a boat. We vote in the cafeteria and decide to occupy again the factory.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, I wish you the very best, and people can learn more about it at ueunion.org. Do I have that right?
Yes, correct.
Okay. Armando Roble, thank you so much for being with us today, and thanks for sharing your story with our viewers and listeners.
All right. Thank you.
Great to have you with us. I do appreciate it. Okay. I promised you I was going to tell you about Iran. This, you know, the bomb, 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 bomb Iran song is being played. And in fact... You know, there's in a way, a piece of this has to do with the whole energy thing. This is clip number 7, Jacob. President Obama talking about, you know, first of all, he doesn't come out and say this, but I want to say this as a setup to this whole concept. Why is it that everybody's hysterical about the Middle East? Because it's where the oil is. And... You know, you've got a bunch of potentates basically that we made back in the 1920s and 30s, and they got the oil and they're starting to have these, you know, whatever. So, anyhow, President Obama, here's his talk on clean energy.
The payoff on these public investments, they don't always come right away, and some technologies don't pan out, and some companies will fail. But as long as I'm president, I will not walk away from the promise of clean energy. I will not give up. I will not cede the wind or the solar or the battery industry to China or Germany because some politicians in Washington refuse to make the same commitment here in America.
Yeah. 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 I mean, this is just, it's like, okay, we don't need to go to war with Iran. Because, you know, it's just, I mean, they got plenty. Well, Fox, oh, Steve Doocy, multimillionaire Steve Doocy, had some different thoughts over at Fox News. Here's Steve.
Well, he continues to beat that dead solar horse, some people might say, on the right.
Yeah, he's continuing to beat that dead solar horse. So, anyhow, the hysteria here around Iran. Iran is trying to build a nuke. Well, this James Risen and Mark Mazzetti writing in the New York Times over the weekend, February 24th. Even the first sentence. Now, tell me why this isn't the story that's being communicated to Americans. Most Americans are convinced that Iran is building a bomb, and everybody knows it, because that's what all the talking heads on TV are saying. Listen to this. Even as the United Nations nuclear watchdog said in a new report Friday that Iran had accelerated its uranium enrichment program, American intelligence analysts continue to believe that there is no hard evidence that Iran has decided to build a bomb. In fact, the fact that Iran has not decided to build a bomb, they say in this article, that it remains the consensus view of America's 16 intelligence agencies. There is no dispute among them that Iran is not building a bomb. Amazing.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
But the neocons, they want another war. Hey, we got out of Iraq. Let's go into Iran. We got to have a war someplace. After all, you got to feed the military-industrial complex.
It's more than just benefits, it's rights that they're attacking. It's more than just rights, corporations at the backing, money that they're stacking, democracy hijacking, and all on the front that our economy's collapsing. You can say what you want, but I call it like it is. Republicans are screwed us now, we dealing with the kids, and we dealing with the bull, and we dealing with the lies. But yo, we got eyes, so let's unionize. I was feeling so free.
Talk media for the sane among us. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio and TV program. Right now, noon to 3 Eastern time. That would be 9 to noon Pacific time. 2 weeks from today, on March 12th, moving to 3 to 6 Eastern time, noon to 3 Pacific time, and live. You know, so contact your local station for more information. Even as the UN nuclear watchdog said in a new report Friday that Iran has accelerated the uranium enrichment program, writes James Risen and Mark Mazzetti in the New York Times on February 24th, last Friday, American intelligence analysts continue to believe there is no hard evidence that Iran has decided to build a nuclear bomb. Basically, what they're doing is they are enriching uranium. They're jacking up the enrichment of uranium. They do have a domestic nuclear power system. This is not to say it's all happy talk and, oh, they're just going to fuel their nukes. India fueled their nukes, and they used the output of that to make a bomb. Pakistan fueled their nukes, and they used the output of that to make a bomb. France fueled their nukes, and they took the output of that to make a bomb. None of them notified the rest of the world they were going to make a bomb. They just did it. North Korea fueled their nukes, and then they made a bomb. We fueled our nukes. Well, we actually made a bomb first. And then we said, hey, you know, this is pretty nasty technology. Maybe we can make some apple pie out of these, or lemonade out of these lemons. And thus the people who felt enormous guilt over bombing Hiroshima and Nagasaki said, let's start Atoms for Peace in the late 1940s, early 1950s. Hasn't worked out so well, but that's a whole other thing. James Clapper, the Director of National Intelligence, this is the guy who's in charge of all of our national intelligence, stated explicitly, I'm quoting from the New York Times on Friday, stated explicitly that American officials believe that Iran is preserving its options for a nuclear weapon, but said there is no evidence it has made a decision or making a concerted push to build a weapon. David H. Petraeus, the CIA director, General Petraeus, the director of the CIA, concurred with that view at the same hearing. Other senior United States officials, including Defense Secretary Leon Panetta, and General Martin E. Dempsey, this guy is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. All the branches of the military, all the military intelligence, have made similar statements in recent television appearances, says the New York Times. So what Iran is doing is defensive. George W. Bush opened the gates of hell to the Middle East and to the United States, frankly, and to our troops who have been there, so many of whom have died there and so many of whom are coming home with post-traumatic stress disorder, which the Army is aggressively trying to redefine as personality disorder so they don't have to pay for it, which is a whole other scandal in and of itself. Got to keep those budgets down, you know. The Republicans are really worried about them budget deficits. Anyhow, the consensus is, among our intelligence agencies, all 16 American intelligence agencies, that Iran is trying to build up enough of uranium that if they decided that they were going to build a nuclear bomb, they could. But they haven't made that decision. In fact, the head Ayatollah came out last year, or year before, and said it is a violation of the Quran to build a nuclear bomb. We're not going to do it. Ahmadinejad, over and over and over again, he keeps saying this is for domestic nuclear energy power. Now, you know, come on, I'm a realist. I know that they are moving down the road that Pakistan moved down the road that India moved down the road that France moved down the road that England moved down the road that Israel moved down. All of these countries had domestic nuclear programs that they used to generate enough uranium so that then they could build a bomb. The consensus of the intelligence agencies, though, is that Iran is not going to build a bomb because they, at least so far, maybe in a couple of years, they're saying 2-3 years from now, maybe they will. But they want to have the ability, because George W. Bush came out and said, there's three evil nations in the world, the axis of evil, and we got to do something about them. And one of them is Iraq. And what did he do? He started dropping bombs on Iraq. 5 million displaced people in Iraq. 5 million. People who have been forced to move from their homes, who have lost everything, who wiped out. 2.5 million of them are not even in the country right now. They're scattered to the four winds. They're in Syria. They're in Jordan. You name it. They're someplace else. Another 2.5 million are internally displaced refugees. Somewhere between 100,000 and 500,000 dead civilians. Not to mention the combatants. So George W. Bush said, okay, three evil nations. The first is Iraq. And we just brought the hammer down on them. Covered the country in depleted uranium. They're having childbirth deformity rates like nobody else on earth right now in Iraq. American soldiers are coming back peeing depleted uranium. Yes, the kidneys excrete uranium. And you're going to see the cancers, 5, 10, 15, 20 years down the road. So North Korea and Iraq and Iran, heard him say that and then saw him do that and said, oh, that's not a good idea. So Kim Jong-il in North Korea, he says, hey, I got enough uranium to build a nuke. I'm going to build a damn thing and blow it up to prove to the world that I've done it, which he did. And all of a sudden, George Bush stopped talking about bombing North Korea. All of a sudden, George Bush shut up and said, let's negotiate with you. Hey, China, Russia, will you help out here, please? Let's have some multilateral talks. And then he started talking about Iran. And you got all these people running around going, Iran this, Iran that, quack, 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 quack. In fact, I got a mashup here. I was going to play it for you, and I got off on my rant. So I got to play this media. Jacob's got it all ready to go. We will do it right after the break. And then, if you've got thoughts you want to share on this, give us a shout. But I also want to get back to Ricky Santorum and the finances, too. We'll be right back. Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
27 minutes past the hour. Should we be bombing Iran? I don't think it's such a good idea. I got it.
That old Beach Boys song, Bomb Iran. Bomb, bomb, bomb.
Bomb, 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 Iran. Bomb, 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 bomb,
yes, bomb, Iran.
Here, only slightly unbalanced. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. And, yeah, that's the mantra coming out of the media. Here is a mashup. Jacob, what's the source of this? Was this Media Matters, I believe, or is it? Or this is over at Democratic Underground. Great. Here you go.
Iran's threat to the United States in the United States.
Tonight, defying the world. The Iranians claim a major advance in their nuclear program.
Iran is changing its game plan.
Further proof that Iran wants to join the club of nuclear nations.
All right, showdown with Iran.
Iran is warning that it may take preemptive action.
ABC World News.
The evidence of a kind of shadow war now being waged by Iran around the world.
Actually, that came from Listening Post, Al Jazeera, and it was published over at commondreams.org is where I caught it this morning. And I just, it's like war is good for business. It's good for the media business. It's good for the military industrial complex business. It gives the president more power, as James Madison pointed out back in 1792. He said war is the greatest, in the context of democracy, it's the greatest thing to be feared. Because it is the parent of armies and taxes, and because it increases and multiplies the powers of the office of the executive of the president. So you can make up your own mind on that. But I just, this whole thing, I just find it amazing. Now, the we have maids in New York City making $60,000 a year. Holy cow. Fox says this is a nightmare. This is an absolute nightmare. Here's clip 14. This is Fox News commentator Sandra.
There's a new union proposal that would give housekeepers a raise to nearly $60,000 a year, plus medical coverage with no out-of-pocket expense to them and no doctor copay. That is the union demand. Any comments, Sandra?
Interesting how all of this sort of follows the whole DSK nightmare, but we're talking about 30,000 hotel maids across New York City, a 29% increase. This is a long-term contract,
yes,
a seven-year contract, not just medical, dental, optical, no out-of-pocket expenses. This is a nightmare.
This is a nightmare. How dare the middle class make money when corporate profits are at the highest they've been in 60 years, 88% of all the gains, all the income in America went to corporate profits. 1% went to increasing wages during a year when 2.2% was the inflation rate, which means that your wages went down while corporate profits went up by not 88%, but 87.8% adjusted for inflation. So anyhow, your thoughts on this. Eileen in Oaksville, New York. Hey, Eileen, what's up?
Hi.
Hello.
Well, I just had a point I wanted to make. Isn't the standard of living in New York City is higher than, say, where I live in Western New York?
Yes, it costs a fortune to live in Manhattan.
Right. $60,000 might sound like a lot to me because my husband makes $40,000 a year, but in New York City, that's probably like nothing because it costs like what? How much to live in a closet in New York City?
Yeah, so, you know, a basic efficiency apartment is probably about $1,500 to $2,000 a month. You know, it's pretty expensive here in D.C. too. The fact of the matter is, $60,000 a year is a lot of money. And Eileen, thanks a lot for the call. I mean, for middle class work, that's a lot of money. And God bless them, they got it. They got it from Donald Trump. They got it from the billionaire hotel owners. They are working in an industry that is incredibly profitable. And if they were successful in getting the owners of those businesses to share some of that profit with them, God bless them. And they're doing tough work. They're doing hard work. Maids work their butts off. I mean, it's tough stuff. So. Anyhow, and the other thing that I think is really interesting in the news, and in fact, this Think Progress just published this. I just sent it to the printer, but I didn't get a chance to grab it. So let me see if I can find it here. Here we go. What's the deal with Mitt Romney and Ron Paul? People, you know, inquiring minds want to know. Judd Legume is writing about this over at the Center for American Progress's blog, Think Progress. Ron Paul has attacked everyone. He's attacked Rick Santorum 22 times. He's attacked Michelle Bachmann. He's attacked Newt Gingrich. He's attacked Tim Pawlenty. How many times has Ron Paul, in all these 20 debates, how many times has he attacked Mitt Romney? Zero. And right now, Ron Paul is running ads in Michigan, and they're not pro-Ron Paul ads. They're attack ads. And they're attacking, guess who? Rick Santorum. What's the deal with Ron Paul and Mitt Romney? What kind of deal have they made? The Santorum campaign is pretty upset about this. And you know, so we'll see how this all shakes out. Jim in Flint, Michigan. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. I appreciate you taking my call. I just thought it was very telling that the commentator for Fox, I think her name was Sandy, in talking about the proposal for the hotel maids in New York, that she described the DSK incident as a nightmare and in the same breath said that the proposal that the maids were making was a nightmare.
Right.
So she's equating a rape of a hotel maid to a hotel maid getting a livable wage.
Right.
So play that clip again. I mean, it's just amazing. I didn't catch that the first time you played the clip, but this time I did.
Yeah, here it is one more time. Clip 14, Jacob.
Any comment, Sandra?
Interesting how all of this sort of follows the whole DSK nightmare, but we're talking about 30,000 hotel maids across New York City.
Right.
A 29% increase. This is a long-term contract.
Yes, it is.
A seven-year contract.
Yeah.
Not just medical, dental, optical, no out-of-pocket expenses. This is a nightmare.
This is a nightmare. This is taking us back to the kind of wages that people made in the 1940s, the 1950s, the 1960s, the 1970s, and the early 1980s in America before Ronald Reagan declared war on unions. This, you know, $60,000 a year in today's money in 1960 would be about $30,000, maybe $35,000 or $40,000, which is basically what somebody who worked at Oldsmobile made. You know, with that kind of dental and health and eye and insurance and all that kind of stuff, it's the kind of money my dad made working in a tool and die shop. Holy cow, that's a nightmare. We can't have the middle class back.
We can't have the middle class back, but I think it just, you know, falls in line about their complete disrespect for women. And most of these jobs are, you know, done by women, if not all of them.
Oh, you're absolutely right. That completely escaped me. And Jim, you are so totally right, because probably 95% of all the hotel maids are female. And, you know, holy, you know, how dare these women actually earn a living wage? That's a man's job. Incredible. Jim, thank you for the call, and thanks for the insight. Tom in Wilson Township, Wisconsin. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Yeah, hey, Tom, how you doing? Yeah, I just caught the beginning of your intro about religious oppression and how masochistic religion can be. And
sadistic.
I was a little shocked.
Or sadistic, yeah.
Or sadistic. And then I was a little surprised to hear Rick Santorum's name at the end. It sounds more like Sharia law is being practiced throughout the European Union, being practiced throughout the United Kingdom.
Sharia law is not actually practiced in the United Kingdom. It doesn't have the force of law. There are Sharia courts, let me finish my sentence here, please. There are Sharia courts that are just like where you can go into counseling at your Catholic church or your Protestant church and say, what should we do? How do we do it? Well, how do you do this according to the law of the church? How do you conduct this? You know, you can't get a divorce in the Catholic religion, for example. And the religious advisor will say, this is how you do it. But they do not have the force of law in the United Kingdom or any place else.
I watched Islamophobia on current TV, and they work outside. They actually work outside of the rule of law of the United Kingdom. They have special facilities where they literally go to. And
that's what I'm saying. It's the same thing where, you know, in the Mormon church or the Catholic church or any other church where they say, okay, you should do this about that. You know, okay, somebody stole something from you. This is how you should pay it back to them. This is how you should work it out with them. You know, if the husband's beating his wife, instead of calling the police, they try to work it out. Or they say, you know, here, come into this shelter. And you're right, there is a separate system there, but the force of law is still a force of law. What's your point, you know, other than you know?
Well, my point is, I'm more of an anarchist. My opinion is that
you're an anarchist.
Government is the enemy of freedom, and freedom is the enemy of government.
Okay, if you want to have freedom, who's going to defend your freedom? How do you define freedom? You want to have freedom from Monsanto poisoning your soil?
No,
how are you going to stop that? You want to have freedom from the Koch brothers running an oil refinery 10 miles upwind of you and covering you with carcinogenic chemicals? Is that freedom?
No, I'm talking about responsibility.
Who's going to defend you from that if that happens?
You know, the government is the only reason we're at war. The government is the only situation.
No, I would submit to you that the reason we're at war is because big oil companies bought Ronald Reagan. They bought his election. They brought him into office, the big oil companies. He took the solar panels off the roof of the White House. He said, we're not going to have a national energy policy anymore. We're going to keep on buying our oil from the Middle East because those big oil companies are making a pile of money on that. And at the time, we didn't have the domestic reserves. We had, you know, we weren't doing fracking or gas or whatever. And bingo.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And you went to war in the Middle East because you had George W. Bush as president, who back a year and a half before he was elected said he was going to go to war in Iraq because it would give him the power to privatize Social Security for his bankster buddies.
He can bomb the world to pieces.
Occupying the airwaves, the Tom Hartman Program. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by Ellen Ratner's new book, Self-Empowerment. Hey, Victoria, I see you're at the White House.
I am in the White House, in the basement.
Yes. Right underneath where all the action's happening, just a few steps down. What's up?
Well, the president today spoke to the National Governors Association, and in his speech, he made a pitch about education and investing in it. He also took quite a few indirect digs at Rick Santorum and his statements about the president and education in recent days, that he's such a snob because he wants people to have the opportunity to go to college. So some of the things Obama said about education...
If I may, Victoria, yes. it's only 12 seconds. Clip number two. Play this, Jacob.
President Obama once said he wants everybody in America to go to college. What a snob.
There you go.
That's it.
So the president responded to that by saying...
I have to make a point here when I speak about higher education. We're not just talking about a four-year degree. We're talking about somebody going to a community college and getting trained for that manufacturing job that now is requiring somebody walking through the door handling $1 million piece of equipment, and they can't go in there unless they've got some basic training beyond what they received in high school.
This is what the president said?
Yes.
Uh-huh. He's right.
Yes.
He's right. I mean, even basic manufacturing jobs now, instead of running a lathe, you're running a computer.
Right. He also said, we can't afford to make higher education a luxury in this country, and he added that it shouldn't be a partisan issue. He said all families ought to be able to afford it. He also talked about the fact that if you've got a degree, your salary statistically is considerably higher than your salary if you have a high school diploma.
Right.
And that if we are competing with other countries who are currently investing in education, this is something we need to be doing right now. He talked about the number of teachers who have been laid off. 250,000 teachers have been laid off. He talked about that. Just over the past year, he said, we've lost 250,000 educators. He said other countries are doubling down. We should too.
This is almost exclusively, by the way, in states where there are Republican governors. They're refusing money. Ohio, John Kasich famously refused the transportation funds for high-speed rail. Down in Florida, Rick Scott refused transportation money. They're cutting their education budgets. They're laying off teachers. I think they're trying to drive their economies into the ground so that they can blame it on Obama for political gain.
Wow.
Well, anyway, that's
wow,
that's my,
fascinating. I mean, well, he made a very strong pitch, and there were a lot of Republican governors in the room, and he said that they had a major role to play.
Yeah.
In investing in education, and he made all his points about Pell Grants. He made his points about also about how credit card debt is not as high now as student debt.
Now, was Jan Brewer in the room? I understood
that. Jan Brewer was in the room because we were doing pool this morning, and Justin was standing behind Jan Brewer and Chris Christie and the one from Louisiana whose name is getting away from me.
Right. Bobby Jindal.
Bobby Jindal. They were all seated right in front of Justin.
Oh, very interesting. Justin from Talk Radio News, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And Jan Brewer, she turned down the invitation to go to dinner with the president.
Yes. It was a scheduling conflict. Because that's the kind of thing that happens when you're invited to dinner with the president at the White House.
Right, right.
It's never
happened to me, but I can tell you there's almost nothing on my schedule that could not be preempted for dinner with the president.
Happens to me all the time. I just can't make those White House functions.
I see. Okay. I understand. It's tough. You and Jan Brewer.
Right.
What else is going on?
This afternoon is expected to approve legislation that would overturn a 2005 Supreme Court decision, which held that state and local governments can take private property under the principle of eminent domain in order to further their economic development plans. This was Kelo versus City of New London, and it was seen by Republicans in particular as a real case of government overreach.
Right.
The Fifth Amendment limits the authority of government to seize property by requiring compensation, as you know, and mandating that the land taken be put to public use.
Yeah, this is where they went after David Souter on this, because he was a liberal, even though he was appointed by a Republican, and he was a Republican. But they went after David Souter on this and said that And somebody tried to actually use eminent domain to take his home in New Hampshire. He has now retired, but so how did the court rule in this case, or did they just
prior to Keeler, the court had said that the seizing of slums and the transfer of that land to private developers fit the public use standards. In Keeler, the Supreme Court upheld the right of New London, Connecticut to take non-blighted land and transfer it to a private developer in a bid to increase local tax revenue.
Right.
And Representative James Sensenbrenner went ballistic.
Right.
And so they've got this bill that they're going to pass, I think, this afternoon. It's a suspension of the rules, which means two-thirds majority. It would prevent states from using eminent domain over property to be used for economic development and establishes a private right of action for property owners if a state or local government violates the new rule.
So the question, will this law then, since this kind of flies in the face of Kilo, was it? Kilo. Since this flies in the face of the Kilo decision, will it be quickly struck down by the Supreme Court?
I don't know.
Or does this fall into the realm of Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution that says that the Supreme Court shall operate within the boundaries of regulations established by Congress?
Isn't that interesting? If it gets through the Senate, isn't that interesting?
It will be. And actually, I think the regulations by Congress have more to do with things like the Code of Judicial Conduct, which Congress should be passing that the Supreme Court has to follow, but they're not going to. In any case, half a minute. What else is going on?
Fascinating new Politico poll has Obama inching up. A lot of good news for Democrats in this poll, which I urge you to read. I know you're skeptical of polls, but it's quite a big one. Very, very broad poll. He's leading Romney. He's leading Santorum. There's a lot of interesting pieces in this. On everything.
I'm not skeptical about the polls. The thing that I'm concerned about is Democrats in Michigan crossing over to vote for Santorum, thinking that they're being really slick by denying Romney a victory, and they're going to end up with Jeb Bush or Chris Christie as president, and that's going to be a tough one. But anyhow, Victoria Jones, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, as I mentioned in the previous hour, George W. Bush in 1977, 78, I guess it was, ran for Congress from Texas. Unsuccessfully, he lost. But the main thing he was running on was Social Security's broke, Social Security's going broke. In fact, he was claiming it was going to go broke by 1985. And therefore, we need to privatize it. We need to turn it over to Wall Street. That perspective lives on. Phil Kirpin is with us. He's the Vice President of Policy for Americans for Prosperity and the author of, I have lost, here it is right here, the author of Democracy Denied. Phil, welcome back to the program.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
AFP, as in Americans for Prosperity, HQ, as in headquarters.org. Is that the right URL?
That'll work, or you can spell it out, AmericansForProsperity.org.
Oh, okay.
Either way. Great.
You've got this plan to privatize Social Security. Tell us about it.
Well, we support the creation of large personal accounts to modernize the program and to incorporate real savings and investments so that workers can retire with higher benefits rather than the lower benefits promised by all of the other so-called reform plans, these green eyeshade plans that either raise taxes or cut benefits, both of which give workers less for more. We'd like to give them more for less by incorporating real investment, and that's the focus of our plan.
Okay, so what you're suggesting then is that people not put money into the government Social Security program, they put it into private accounts, and they grow those in the stock market, something like that, is that it?
Well, there'd be a whole range of investments available that people will be able to choose. It's a voluntary plan, and there's a guarantee in place that they can do no worse than what the current system promises. So this is all upside, and it can deliver through increased capital formation, increased investment, and real returns. Even Bill Clinton was for a version of this. He didn't want the personal accounts, but he did want to invest Social Security funds in real investments to increase the rate of return.
Sounds like what you're suggesting is what the Chilean government did in 1981 when the dictator Augusto Pinochet shoved this down their throats.
Yeah, the Chilean plan is one of the models that we looked at. It's been very successful. It's a very popular plan, and people would never give up those accounts now that they have them.
Well, actually, they are. They're giving them up in droves. The management fees, this is the thing. I mean, when you turn your investment account, right now, you know, the Social Security Administration takes about 0.9% for all the administration. You cut all those checks, mail them out, find, track down fraud, everything. It's 0.9%. The returns in Chile, I'm actually looking at the stats here over the last 30 years. Return on individual accounts from 1982 to 1986, for example, was 15.9%. But after the banks took their management fees, what the people got was 0.3%, less than 1%. Returns from 1991 to 1995 averaged 12.9%, which sounds great, but after you take out the management fees, it was 2.1%. For a new worker enrolling in 1996, the 3.5% gross yield actually amounted to a minus 6.8% return after taking management fees into account. These fees are used to pay for sales staff, to cover marketing expenses. These AFPs compete fiercely for the business. The upshot of this is why 50% of all enrollees switch investment funds every year. And the government now, under Bachelet, has rolled out basically said you can go back to government Social Security if you want, and people are doing it in droves. I mean, the returns between 1995 and 1998 were not minus 2.5%, 3.5%, 4.7%, minus 1.1%.
Well, Tom, that was roller coaster? Even the period of the worst global economic crisis that we've seen, and yet relatively
in the 90s. No, that was the period of stability during the Clinton years.
2008, but the Chilean system actually has a guarantee that is triggered if people do worse than the old system would have promised them. There hasn't been a single collection on that guarantee since they went to the personal account system, because the returns
because it was put into place by a military dictatorship.
the returns have been higher than they would have been promised under that old system.
The other problem is that the Chilean system is not, and did not, that's basically a retirement system. Our Social Security system, and you say, you know, if for example, you use the example of this community in Texas that has opted out of Social Security for retirement, and they're getting a better return than Social Security does on their investment, because Social Security right now is getting about 1% because they invest in treasuries. And all that's well and good, except for the fact that over a third of all the money that Social Security pays out is not retirement. It's for people like my friend Michael Hutchison in Santa Fe, who went out running in his 30s, maybe early 40s, slipped, broke his neck, and he's a quadriplegic ever since. He's been in a wheelchair for the last 15, 20 years. And he is completely, all of his expenses are paid for with Social Security. Any 25-year-old in America has a $1.5 to $4 million insurance policy that will protect them until the day they die in all regards, with food, housing, and medicine, in the form of Social Security, which is the policy that my friend Michael took, you know, said, okay, cash it out. My cousin was gave birth to a child with spinal bifida. Again, the Social Security paid for that.
Doesn't affect the disability plan. It's focused on the old age and survivors program.
But when you start sucking money out of the Social Security trust fund, you're going to affect everything.
Well,
we
don't take any money out of the trust fund. The transition is financed with general fund transfers.
So according to the CBO, that's going to be $6.9 trillion.
We use cuts to other unrelated federal spending. There's already been a
$6.9 trillion?
I don't have the paper in front of me. I think the transition costs were somewhat less than that. But the point here is, you know, if you want workers to get a better return than they get right now, and you want them to get better benefits without having to pay more,
then just turn it over to Wall Street.
You can accomplish that. Well, you don't turn it over to Wall Street or Washington, because I think most Americans don't trust either of them. You turn it over to individual Americans and give them ownership and control.
So I should turn it over to my next-door neighbor?
No, you should have control of it yourself, Tom, and you should make that
and do what with
yourself.
It?
And invest however you think is best.
So you're saying that
with a slate.
You're saying that the guy who lives in the apartment next door to me, who's 75 years old and has dementia, he should be making his own investment decisions.
Well, I think that if someone's not of sound mind, then they should designate someone to make those decisions. We've got a whole legal system that deals with that situation now. The point is,
Phil, Social Security is fine. It's got a $2.5 trillion surplus in its account.
No, it's going to be It has no surplus.
It has
bonds in the notional trust fund, but it's operating at a cash flow.
Phil,
deficit.
That is so dishonest.
No,
that
it's
so dishonest for you to say
according
that.
According to the program's own trustees. Stop
filibustering me for a second here.
All right.
The program, the trust fund, which didn't exist before Reagan fixed Social Security in 81, 82, that trust fund was to pay off the rabbit going through the python of the baby boomers. It was supposed to build up to the point where it had a couple of $1 trillion in it, and then it was supposed to pay out as the collections went negative. We're now moving into that direction. So, you know, this is a classic example of, and I don't want to call you a liar, but I don't know how else to say this, about figures don't lie, but liars can figure. The fact of the matter is that Social Security has a $2.5 trillion trust fund. We are paying that down, which we're supposed to be doing. We're in negative payments. Sure, fine. And it's going to be solvent for at least another 25 years, 27 years. And from that point until the end of history, it'll pay 70 to 80% of benefits. And if we simply lifted the cap so the people making over $106,000 paid the same as everybody else, it would be solvent forever. Tell me that what I'm saying is not the truth, Phil.
Well, I think it's a mischaracterization because I...
How?
Well, because the fact that Social Security is already cash flow negative means that they've got to redeem the special interest. Well, if you think the Greenspan Commission was the right approach, then yes, you could say that it's supposed to be. I think the problem was that Congress was able to spend all of that revenue all of those years.
They didn't spend it. It's $2.5 trillion invested in treasuries.
Yeah, there was no savings and investment to back that up. It effectively was...
There actually are. George Bush went and waved those treasuries around and said, look at these worthless pieces of paper. They were treasury bills, the same as he was born with in his trust fund when he was born.
Issue non-marketable treasury bills that can't be sold to the public that sit in a filing cabinet.
Can be sold to the government.
But Tom, when those treasury bills are redeemed, you have
as they're being right now,
you have to have a general fund transfer. Where does the general fund get the money to make that transfer? You've got to raise taxes or cut other spending elsewhere.
Where does the general fund get to pay back the bonds from the Chinese, Phil?
Existed. My point is, Tom, if you think there's no problem with benefits being cut 70%, then yes, don't do it.
That's not going to happen.
If you think
that's not going
to
happen.
Tax hikes on people to make the return even worse, people to pay more in and get less out, then yes, that could be an option.
Yes, I'm in favor of tax hikes on people, on millionaires and billionaires. Yes, I'll cop to that. Phil Kirpin, you can check it out at AmericansForProgress.org.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Thanks a lot for being with us, Phil.
Got it.
Good talk. We'll be back 15 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Larry in Rochester, Minnesota. Hey, Larry, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Hey, I was just one of your segments a little while ago. You were talking about Iran, you know, Bob Amaran. What makes us as Americans think that we have the right to tell who has nuclear bombs?
Yeah.
Israel has them. India has them.
Pakistan. France, England,
right.
North Korea, China, Russia, right. Us. Yeah, I mean, the list goes on and on.
So why are we getting so excited about Iran?
No, we're getting so excited about it because there's money to be made in war. The tragedy is that lives are lost in war. Nations are shattered. Here's the thing that concerns me the most. Larry, thank you for the call. The thing that concerns me the most is that when you look at the death of empires, and you can go back to the Greek Empire. You can go back before that to the Sumerian Empire. You can go forward from that to the Roman Empire. You can go forward from that to the British Empire, the French Empire, the Catholic Empire, the Soviet Empire. In fact, the Chinese Empire of the third millennium. When an empire moves to an economy that is based on continuing war, then the empire is doomed to die within a generation. And it is my opinion that we have moved into that realm. We are now at the point where if we just said, okay, no more wars, no more military bases, we're going to do what Ron Paul says, our economy would go in the tank so fast because so much of our economy depends on war. And we've never been there before, and we shouldn't be there now. And this is what these guys have brought to us, and it's just a disaster. Diane in Lansing, Michigan. Hey, Diane, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I love your show. Well, I think I've discovered why Rick Santorum doesn't want anybody to Google his name.
You Googled it, huh?
I did. And apparently, to one of the websites, his nickname is Rooster.
Oh, that's interesting.
So I understand what's going on.
Yeah. The other one not to Google now is Gingrich. Apparently, there's Gingrich has a naughty word associated or metaphor or whatever, but... Anyhow, so Rooster, that's very interesting. Here's the thing that I'm concerned about, Diane. You're in Michigan, and I saw where the head of the Democratic Party, I believe, the other day said, or maybe it was the head of the Republican Party, said words to the effect of, it's fine if the Democrats want to vote in the Republican primary. And, of course, they legally can. And I know that there are Democrats in Michigan who think that they're going to gum up the Romney works. They're going to gum up the Republican works by voting for Santorum and having Romney lose his own home state. And let me appeal to my listeners on WDTW in Detroit and WTKG in Grand Rapids and you know, XM Sirius and Free Speech TV and viewers all and Ann Arbor, I forget the call letters, all across the state to say that's a bad move to make. And here's why. Mm-hmm. If Mitt Romney is denied the nomination.
Republican primary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if he doesn't make the nomination and they go to a brokered convention, they're going to come out of that brokered convention with a stronger candidate than Mitt Romney, somebody who's going to be harder for Obama to beat. And it's probably going to be either Jeb Bush or Chris Christie or Marco Rubio. And if it's Marco mm-hmm. Rubio in particular, he's going to be very, very hard for Obama to beat because he's young, he's Hispanic. He is the Republican Barack Obama. He's the guy that nobody thought could possibly win. And he's charismatic and he's a brilliant speaker and all these kinds of things. He's got a great story. His parents were immigrants from Cuba, et cetera. And so, you know, I would say, you know, let the Republicans do their thing. Don't mess in their primary. And if Mitt Romney's the nominee, then, you know, the opposition research has been done. People already have a negative opinion of him across the United States. It'll be easier for President Obama to beat him than, frankly, I think, to beat any of the other, you know, any of the stronger Republican candidates. Santorum is not going to win. He's not going to come out of this thing as the winner. He's only going to be the spoiler. And I don't think that we should be participating in that. Diane, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. I appreciate it. And thanks for watching us there in Lansing. Dave in Kansas City, Kansas. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind?
Hello, Tom. Yeah, I'm one of the 20% have to pay more taxes.
What do you mean?
Well, what you was talking about earlier. Never mind that.
Okay.
I've got a solution on this Afghanistan thing.
All right.
We accidentally destroyed their property, their Korans. Can we get a movement going that would replace their Korans and uphold his apology? You know, he said he was sorry that we destroyed them.
Right.
And we destroyed their property. We ought to replace their property.
You know, it's actually a very good idea. You know, if somebody created a fund and, you know, got $5,000-$10,000 and bought, you know, 20,000-30,000 Korans and shipped them over to Afghanistan and said, here, you know, a gift to the Afghan people. The problem with it, though, Dave, is that what they're objecting to, and I encourage you to read some of the statements that are being made by the Afghan people about this, that what they're objecting to isn't so much that we burned the Koran. That's the straw that broke the camel's back. What they're objecting to is that we've killed 100,000 of their civilians. That 20 children starved to death or froze to death in Kabul last month, because there's so many internal refugees. Hundreds of thousands of people have been displaced. That we rained war on this country. We took a country that had a gross domestic product, a GNP, a GDP of $2 billion a year, and we're spending $14 billion a year on basically bombing that country and fighting a war in it. It has the Karzai government is totally propped up by us. This was the second poorest country in the world, and we have poured hundreds of billions of dollars into death and destruction and virtually nothing, very, very little anyway, into putting it back at least to where it was. And meanwhile, they got drones coming out of, you know, firing missiles out of the sky, blowing up people by accident, killing off families. You had a couple of months ago, you had a bunch of soldiers who killed a bunch of Afghan civilians, and then one of them peed on a corpse, and that picture went viral. I mean, if this was just about burning the Korans, then I think that would be a great idea, and in fact, I would lead the charge. Dave, thank you for the call. But this isn't just about burning the Korans. This is what happens when one country militarily occupies another country, particularly one that has a different culture. You will eventually, inevitably have, just as if Mexico tried to occupy the United States, people will rise up and say no.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And it is why it is so important for us to realize that what George Bush did by you know, occupying Iran and Afghanistan was more than just a war crime. Yep, that's the good, the bad, and the very, very alachthonously ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, a supplement for the brain. The good. Corey Husick. Husick, a 17-year-old high school student from Pennsylvania, sent out a loud and clear message to the Heartland Institute, the conservative organization planning to create a nation of global warming deniers. Husick directly addressed Heartland CEO Joseph Bast in a petition letter sponsored by Al Gore's Climate Reality Group, asking him to cease and desist his organization's efforts to create student conspiracy theorists. Husick wrote, "Please be advised, your entire premise is false. The reality is that our climate is changing now, and human activities are a primary cause." He went on to state that our nation's students need to learn how to cope with the effects of global warming, not pretend it doesn't exist. It's great to see a student like Corey, part of the future of our nation, standing up to protect education from corporate interests and bad science. The bad. Arizona congressional candidate Frank Antonori. At an Arizona Tea Party rally last week, Antonori told a group of about 300 people that President Obama's presidency is very similar to Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait in 1990. Antonori was describing his life before politics, in which he served in the military during Operation Desert Storm. Here it is.
To liberate their own country after it had been taken from them by Saddam Hussein. Imagine that, having your country taken from you, and then having to fight for it to get it back. We're at that point here in this country.
While making a comment comparing the President of the United States to a brutal dictator would normally be considered astonishing, it's nothing new coming from the Tea Party. When will Mr. Antonori and his Tea Party friends learn that this type of vitriolic rhetoric has no place in politics? And the very, very ugly Rick Berman. Viewers of the Oscar broadcast last night may have noticed a peculiar ad during the show. An ad attacking the Humane Society of America, claiming that only a small portion of donations made to them actually go to help fund animal shelters. Here it is.
Attention, consumer protection alert. If you've seen this ad or donate to the Humane Society of the United States, you should know that only one penny of every dollar donated goes to local pet shelters.
Yeah, this ad spot was purchased by the Center for Consumer Freedom, a corporate-run front group run by right-winger Rick Berman. Berman is closely tied to the food industry and has attacked the Humane Society on many occasions, saying that they are engaged in, his words, a slow but steady push to take away consumer choices by forcing meat, eggs, and dairy foods out of more Americans' reach, end quote. Berman has a long history of spreading misinformation in order to protect the interests of the food industry. His latest ad is an intimidation tactic designed to show the Humane Society that if they work against the interests of corporate America, they will be met with a firestorm of misinformation and negativity, and that is very, very ugly. And in fact, some of the things that the Humane Society is up to. The fact of the matter is, only a small percentage of the money that Humane Society spends actually does go to local shelters, because they're spending a lot of money working in anti-cruelty areas. It's not like they're having dinner in the Bahamas. It's not that at all. Instead, for example, they're backing anti-cruelty bills, including the Egg Products Inspection Act amendment of 2012, which this from Ian Milheiser, posting over at thinkprogress.org, which would prevent egg-laying hens from being packed into tiny cages that leave them with virtually no room to move around. They fight animal cruelties in the courts, in the state legislatures, in the federal legislature. But Berman, he's got this long, and so, you know, he's going after the Humane Society by way of saying, how dare you support legislation that works against the big food industry, the big ag industry? And it's amazing. This is the same guy who brought you the sweet scam. Berman is behind a campaign called Sweet Scam that basically says that, you know, sugar is good for you. It doesn't hurt your teeth. Trans fats. He's got another campaign. The website has now been pulled down. But he claims that trans fats actually may possess health benefits. Right. The steak diet. He's got a website that says you want to shed unwanted pounds, eat nothing but steak. He's got another website that talks about soft drinks for athletes. Another one, fast food marathon. Berman also touts a marathon runner who proclaims, I love running and I love fast food. Might as well combine the two. And, of course, he's a global warming denier. Why? Because he's going after Al Gore, former vice president, who said that a high meat diet fosters global warming because they're cutting down rainforests for cattle to graze. So this is a guy who's like a front man for big ag. And as Ian Millhiser writes over at the Center for American Progress, Berman's latest effort is nothing less than an intimidation campaign designed to send a clear message to charities that if they work against the interests of a wealthy corporation, they will find themselves on the receiving end of a hit job led by deep-pocketed industries capable of throwing away more than $1 million on a single ad. A 30-second ad on the Oscars last night cost $1.7 million, or at least that's the average, according to the Center for American Progress. It's really amazing when you think about it. Really amazing. Peggy in Los Angeles listening on K-Talk. Hey, Peggy, what's up?
Regarding Ron Paul being less critical of Romney.
Yes.
Ron Paul believes in both economic and cultural freedom. And while I disagree with Ron Paul's economic ideas, he and I may agree that one of the worst things that could happen to our country would be to have a religious fanatic know-it-all president who would take us back to the founding of our country, where many of our ancestors came here to escape state and religious intolerance.
He would take us back 100 years before the founding of our country.
Well, yes. Plus what's really important is maybe he recognizes, which is what I recognize, is right now you've got the Catholics and the evangelicals and the Mormons all in bed together over abortion and over gays and all this stuff. But what it'll happen is if one of them gets in, this whole thing, once you open the door to religious running the country, you end up with them all in a battle with each other, and it'll tear our country apart like it did Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
Because that's really what that was all about.
Yep. Absolutely. Thank you very much. Well said. Protestants versus Catholics. Actually, it was a little more than that. It was more about the Catholic Ireland being invaded by Protestant England. But, I get your point. And very well said. Jackie in Napa, California. Hey, hey, Jackie, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. A couple of things I wanted to comment on was with Phil Kirpin,
mm-hmm.
that you just had on earlier, and he's talking about privatizing and giving us poor workers out here all of this wonderful ability to make as much money, quote, as the rich as the 1% can make,
right.
You know, and the bottom line is that what they don't understand about Americans, because they don't obviously have the same connection to this country that that the rest of us do, is that we aren't interested in making profit off of everything we do. Yeah, when I give to a charity, to me, that when you're talking about Social Security and you're talking about a group, you're talking about people who can't afford $1 million to invest.
Right.
Individually.
Right.
You know, if we're lucky if we got 50 right now.
Yeah, and if there wasn't Social Security, my friend Michael Hutchison would be dead now. My niece would have been dead, who was born with spina bifida or bifida, however you say it.
My cousin was born with spina bifida, and he's the longest living person with it.
Yeah.
You know, and without the care he got, thanks to Social Security disability when he was born, he wouldn't be here either.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible. You know, and my niece died, I think, in her late teens.
And this guy's I'm sorry, Tom. But when you were talking about Argentina and Brazil, Chile, I'm sorry. Anyway, and I'm thinking, look, when we can all, and President Obama proved it with his election last time, if we all give a buck, $5, whatever we got in our pockets, then we've got power.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Social Security is about. We all give in to the pot. I don't want a surplus on that.
No, we want a nice, stable system. Jackie, well said. I gotta move along, but thank you very much for the call. It's great to hear from you, and appreciate it. Larry in Kalmar, Iowa. Hey, Larry, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling great. But I'll get better. How about you, Larry?
Yeah. I'm dying, but I'm trying to do it real slow.
Oh, that's a good plan. Okay. I guess ultimately we all are. Right?
We all are. Yeah, life's a terminal condition.
Yeah.
But I wanted to ask you, you know, I respect your opinion and everything. I've learned a lot from you. I know Ricky Santorum doesn't want me to go to get my PhD from Tom Hartman U, but, you know. Anyway, I wanted to know, what is the right size for a tree?
You know, Louise and I were talking about that last night. We were trying to figure it out because we've been, my first thought was that he'd been way up north, because when we, our second or third wedding anniversary back in the 70s, we went up to Moosonee, which is on the southern tip of the James Bay, you know, the Hudson Bay, way up north in Canada. And the trees are like 4 feet tall there because they have so little summer that, you know, you have an entire forest of 4 foot tall trees. And you can see right over the tops of them. And you get farther north and the trees get smaller and thinner until finally they just vanish altogether. And so I thought maybe that was it. And then it suddenly hit me. Mitt Romney has a mansion in Southern California. And in California, they've got the redwoods. And the redwoods are, like, really tall.
Yeah.
So I'll, you know, because the question that nobody has asked Mitt is, what's the wrong height of a tree? And that's the question I'd like to ask, right? He says, the trees are the right height. Okay, well, what's the wrong height? Is it the redwoods in California, or is it the really short trees up in Alaska and Canada? I don't know. I don't know what he's thinking of. Who knows? But I'm guessing he was comparing it to the redwoods. Larry, thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We have a socialized military, says Mark in Minnetonka, Minnesota. Talk to him right after this.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Welcome back, Mark in Minnetonka, Minnesota. You want to point out something about our military?
Yes, I do, Tom.
Go for it.
Thanks for your good work. I'm just saying that the military is perhaps the most socialist of our government agencies.
Not perhaps. Their rules. It is. It provides housing. It provides medical care. It provides food. It provides transportation.
Training.
Everything. Yeah.
Medicine, absolutely.
In fact, you could argue that it's not socialist, it's communist.
Well, yeah, if you think about the uniforms and the rules and regulations, the routine, the protocol, the procedures.
Yeah, they control the means of production and supply. I mean, to the extent that they buy things from private contractors, I suppose it's not entirely communist, but it certainly is, you know, wildly socialist over the top, more so than any other country in the world, although every country's military is socialist. And I think, you know, I think that's why Dwight Eisenhower, having come out of a military that had seen integration, that had seen, you know, that was at the leading edge of things, that had a national health care system, that had the civil service restriction in place, that the five-star general didn't make more than 20 times what a PFC made at that time back in the 1950s. And I think it's now like 30, 35 times, something like that. But there's still this barrier, right? That's why the Eisenhower administration was so, what we might today call, liberal. That's why Dwight Eisenhower in 1954 wrote a letter to his brother, Edgar, saying that, you know, should any political party try to do away with labor unions or Social Security, you would never hear from that political party again. He said, I know that there are a few Texas oil men, the Hunt brothers and others, a few Texas oil millionaires who think that it's possible. He said, but their number is small and they are stupid. And verbatim quote from Dwight Eisenhower. So
the reason I bring this up, though, is because the negative mantra that's put out by the major media and or some of the Republicans about the dangers of socialism, because they're more likely to support and engage this military engine than the other party.
Yeah.
And to improve their likelihood of success at achieving certain goals that they may not be sharing with us.
Yeah, they hate socialism, but they sure do love our socialist military. Excellent point, Mark. Thanks for calling and making it. Ann in Phoenix, listening on KPHX. Hey, Ann, what's up?
Hi. Well, I was online. I did think of a question I'd love to hear you answer, sort of a postscript to my other question. Is I've heard that the Bank of America bailout, the $26 billion, that a portion of it or all of it, some of it, is going to be on the taxpayers' shoulders, and I'd like to know the veracity of that. My other comment is, from Reagan forward through Obama, we've had multimillionaires and billionaires. Everybody's yammering that government spends too much, Obama's this, Obama's that. Why haven't they created jobs? Not one commentator or whatever, the moderators, have asked them, why haven't you gone out and created jobs? Instead of creating a revolving account at Tiffany's, why don't you guys, who are all millionaires, create jobs? You know, it's just disgusting.
Well, that's
and I'll
you know,
take my answer off there.
Okay, thank you, Ann. Thanks very much for the call. That's what Romney's going to campaign on, is saying that he did create jobs. And by being one of the early funders of Staples, arguably Bain Finance, Bain Capital was, you know, did create those jobs. But on the other hand, they also stripped a hell of a lot of jobs out of a lot of other companies because, they, you know, they're a pump and dump shop. you know, private equity used to be called, well, actually, it's gone through a whole variety of names over the years. But private equity is not about growing companies. It's not venture capital, and he's hoping everybody will think it is. But that said, your question about the banksters and this $26 billion fund, my understanding is that it has to come from the banks. On the other hand, it's probably a tax-deductible expense, so we'll end up paying for it anyway. Or you could say, well, those banks wouldn't have, you know, the top six banks have assets equal to 65% of the total GDP of this nation, that they wouldn't have that if we hadn't bailed them out. So you could say it's our money. You know, there's a bunch of different ways that you could look at that. I'm not sure which one is absolutely definably accurate or if there ever will be such a thing. Steve in Phoenix. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks so much for enlightening us to so many of the stories that are out there that just don't come across on the mainstream media.
It's an honor, Steve. What's up?
Okay. The thing with Social Security, thanks for standing up for that, you and Bernie. The last thing people need to do is you know, we need it's like an annuity-type system, and that's what we need.
Yes.
You know, if people have any extra money, they certainly can put it in 401s or IRAs or an open account. And, you know, the vast majority of Americans, I don't think, really understand to make the choices and you know, that are necessary for their main retirement income in a security-based system, you know, yep. whereas if they were in the market, a lot of people are prone to sell at the wrong times during bear markets.
Sure. People who are not professionals tend not to make money in the market. I mean, it's just that simple. And,
right.
You know, wealth and who wants their retirement to be up to the whims of the billionaires on Wall Street? Steve, excellent point. Thanks for the call. Carl in Nashville, Tennessee. Carl, we have a minute to the end of this, to the end of today's show. It's all
absolutely
yours.
Absolutely. And I can do it in a minute. Well, I live in one of the reddest of red states. If there was a redder color, redder than red, Tennessee would be that. Mm-hmm. And one of my favorite things to do is to call into their little talk shows when they're having their fake outrage and enter into their bubble and just blow it up. Today's fake outrage was President Obama apologizing to Afghanistan. And I called in. I said, you know what? I totally agree with you. The president shouldn't have apologized for Abu Ghraib. And President Bush shouldn't apologize for them using the Quran as target practice. And then and that's what you get from these guys, you know, President Bush. And I said, you remember President Bush. I know you try not to remember him, and the Republican Party try not to remember him and his failed economic policies. But you guarantee that the American people and the American economy, nay, the world economy, do remember
We remember George Herbert Hoover Bush. We remember him very well. Carl, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. You did a great job in our last minute of the show. And, don't forget, democracy begins when you get out there and get active, when you show up, when you participate, occupy something, occupying the airwaves. Tom Hartman here with you saying, don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.